Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, you know the drill. We record on Thursday morning. So I want to start with two tweets. Here's the first tweet. Lloyd Doggett tweeted, "Doctors are jailed, women's health derailed. Until abortion access is restored, we have failed." And then Shannon Watts, who I think is moms that demand the end of sort of gun violence, that kind of thing. So Shannon Watts wrote this: "Over 800 police officers were at the parade today, and over 1 million civilians who were allowed to be armed. Yet they couldn't stop a dozen people from being shot." She's absolutely right. 800 police and 1 million civilians who are allowed to be armed. Think about that. Just think about that. Anyway, we have lost Scott Braddock this morning. He didn't have internet access. He was on his way to Beaumont. So, Monsieur Curry, thank you so much for agreeing to stay for the hour. But for the first half hour, he's going to be joined by Dr. Stephen Green. So let me remind everyone, Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut and a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. He was also the former head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back, Mr. Curry.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And Stephen Green has been a professor of political science at North Carolina State since 2002. His research and expertise focuses on American public opinion and American elections. Additionally, Dr. Green has specific interests in gender politics, media politics, and political parties, and North Carolina politics, which is always interesting. Welcome back, Stephen.
Great to be back with you.
Before we begin, I'm going to do a little bit of a point of personal privilege. I'm looking at a story at the Washington Post, and this story made me smile. And here's the title of the story. You ready? Ralph Nader is on the line. Of course he'll hold. The longtime activist who turns 90 this month still believes in the power of the press. That's why he regularly peppers journalists with critiques and even better, suggestions. And guess what? That's what I do all the time. But I have a Ralph Nader story for both of you. So I was doing radio on the Hubbard stations in the Twin Cities, huge stations, 100,000 watt, 50,000 watt stations. They were actually hiring me to do morning drive time radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I was still living in Hopkinton, New Hampshire, and they set up a studio in my third floor apartment in Hopkinton so I could do morning drive time radio. After all, my name is Arnie Arneson. I went to St. Olaf. Who would know, you know? But of course, I was always forthcoming with my audience. So it is a Sunday night, and I have to get up at 4:30 in the morning in order to prep to do the morning drive time show out of the Twin Cities. And I get home early and the phone rings and I pick up the phone and on the other end, it says, "Hi, Arnie, this is Ralph." Okay. Like Ralph, who? It's clear. He goes, "Arnie, it's Ralph Nader." And I said, "Oh, of course, you call all the time, Ralph." I'm going, "So what the heck are you calling me about now? Like, what's the point?" So he said, "Well, we're sitting here in Washington. We realize that Paul Wellstone died and that we need a really good progressive candidate to run for that seat. So we thought that we would want to urge you to move back to Minnesota and to consider running for the U.S. Senate." This is what he's doing. He knew I lived in the Twin Cities. I worked in the IDS building. I went to St. Olaf. I had lots of connections to Minnesota, but I'm a resident of New Hampshire. I mean, that's like, you know, and by this point in time, I'd already run for governor, run for Congress. I'm kind of a known political quantity. And I said, "Ralph, I am so honored that you would even think of me, but I'm not a carpetbagger. And even though I love Minnesota and I know a lot about it, I'm doing morning drive time, you know, I mean, I'm talking to the governor like once a week, but I don't have that connection to place. And in order for me to be good at what I do, and actually for me to be a progressive about what I do, I need to have that sense of geography and that sense of connection. And while it's a lovely gesture, thanks, but no thanks." That was my conversation with Ralph Nader on a Sunday night. So trust me about this headline. You know, of course he calls the press. Of course he'll go on home. I mean, heck, he calls Arnie. I mean, what does that tell you? But that's my Ralph Nader story, which I just thought was just unbelievable as I'm reading this because it's so him. You know, he doesn't wait for someone else to do it. He just says, okay, this is how a country I want to believe in, and this is what I want to do. So that's exactly what he does. Anyway, that was my thought du jour, and I wanted to at least nothing else raise that with you. So I'm going to start with you, Mr. Curry, since you are our regular. And I asked both of you, I gave you like 30 topics, so I apologize for that. But then I also said, pick three, or, you know, look at three that really sort of want to float your boat. You mentioned the special counsel's report, Bill Curry, and that you wanted to talk about that because of what it did to Joe Biden. I think it's important because it's not only about what he did, but what he did, which is to hurt him in a place where he is the most vulnerable, because if there's anything we know about Joe Biden, it's his age. And we hear about it morning, noon, and night. And frankly, it's not his age, Bill Curry. It's how he presents his age. And nobody talks about that. And I think that when I think about Bernie, do I hear people going, oh, Bernie, he's so old. Oh my God, Bernie. I mean, how can he do this? Bernie's so old. And they're about the same age. If not, Bernie may even be older for all I know. But it's a really interesting issue. But I would love to get your reaction to Special Counsel Robert Hur, and because he's being asked to testify before Congress, I believe, next month.
I have two conflicting theories, responses. Reading Dahlia Lithwick, whom I always enjoy reading, and I agree with most of what she said. But on our side of this, there are two things that are really need to be pointed out. The first is that what Hur did is what Comey did. It is in a long tradition of Republicans whom Democrats foolishly rely on to go about the law, who develop perhaps a professional reputation among other lawyers, which is very easy to do. James Comey was a very partisan careerist, and idealistic attorneys in that area of the law have trouble seeing the law's degradation by power politics. They always want to give this person, the people, the benefit of the doubt. And so we've set ourselves up for the Bob Muellers and the Bob Hurs and the James Comeys. We've pinned our hopes on the Sandra Day O'Connors and the Anthony Kennedys. And if there's a rule that should be clear by now, it is that we should never do that. And by the way, it goes both ways in the partisan divide. Barack Obama should never have hired James Comey, who'd been an active partisan Republican. But he didn't need to hire a Democrat. There should be a rule that you look for a genuinely nonpartisan professional. And there are plenty of them out there. And so that was just tragic. And what he did.
Let me do a quick sidebar, because you're absolutely, he should never should have appointed him to be special counsel. Okay, that there's no question about that. I mean, given his history, and it's his province. It's the opportunity was to do whatever he wanted, and to do this, like, somehow they have to bend over to look fair. Like yeah. From a side that has no concept of what fairness is. But let me just remind you, in my own state of New Hampshire, okay, John Lynch, I'm not sure what he did, but I know he handed out his cell phone. The governor, John Lynch, who was actually elected four times. Do you know who he appointed to be his attorney general? Kelly Ayotte. The Republican, he reappointed her to be his attorney general. 6 months later, she runs for the U.S. Senate as a Republican, which is what she was, and she wins. Like, what was that about? He had every opportunity to, like, bring someone in to be the AG, and it's the Democrat that appoints Kelly. Look at me, I'm so bipartisan. And then she turns around and flips the bird at him and runs for U.S. Senate and wins. So I just want to say it's so typical, it makes me nauseous. Keep going.
I'll just wrap this up so we can hear from Stephen. But number one, the Democrats, if God smiles and we take the presidency in both houses of Congress, we should do what Obama didn't do when he refused to have lookbacks at Iraq and lookbacks at the corruption on Wall Street. When he said, "Yeah, we're gonna move forward." What happened with Mueller? What happened with Trump and the Mueller failed to expose? What's happened here? We need to examine this process and what went into it. And lastly, I'll just say that I said there were two sides to it. The other side is that Biden doesn't just appear old; he's old. Yeah. And I still hold out the dream that somehow the members of his family, I think any family and staff that have encouraged him to run are committing a form of elder abuse. He is not what Robert Hur described, but he's carrying. When I was in the Clinton White House, I look at the polling data every morning. We won that race because Bob Dole was too old, and he could be leading a youth wave in this election. And this is a huge liability. You mentioned Ralph Nader. At 90, Ralph has more vitality and presents better. So does Bernie. So does Nancy Pelosi. So do a whole number of people. Biden is not a young age. That's his problem. And he really isn't. And our inability to have a succession plan faced with someone this old and this important position reflects poorly on our party. It's not too late to do something.
And Stephen, before we leave this topic, I just want to sort of read some of the things that I think the Republicans are going to make hay out of. Republican lawmakers will surely hone in on the various examples of Biden's unreliable memory contained in the report. Heard described Biden as a, quote, sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with a poor memory. He also said Biden failed to remember the year his son Beau died, as well as the years he served as vice president. I mean, those are withering, withering accusations. Not that you should remember the year that Beau died. I mean, there are things I don't remember about my husband's death or my aunt's death, and I don't even remember the day that I got married. The years that he served as vice president, that to me is a little bit more frightening. But the question then becomes, what was the point of that? What was the point of that, except to be gratuitous?
Well, I mean, I think we all know, right? The point was to be gratuitous. You know, two things are true here, I would say. You know, it was a partisan, gratuitous, cheap shot that no person of integrity in that position had any business doing, but that hasn't, well, that says about his integrity. Secondly, nonetheless, you know, I don't think Biden is nearly as bad as her portrays him. But I mean, you know, as Bill is saying, he is, I don't know if I want to say too old. I'm not sure what it means to be too old, but, you know, definitely older than ideal. You know, definitely lost not just a step, but a couple of steps. Definitely, and I think this is a really important point that I like that Bill brought out, you know, presents as an old man in a way that many other politicians, his senior, in fact, do not come across. That, again, just I think on a gut level for voters is like, oh, that reminds me of my elderly, frail grandparent, aunt, parent, self, whatever, in ways.
Right, in the assisted living place that they're staying in, you know? I mean, but let me just say something, Stephen, and that is, I posted this on Facebook. How old is the Pope? He's 87, okay? They didn't even elect him until he was 76, okay?
He doesn't have the nuclear codes.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, it's...
But there is no question in my mind that the Pope actually may be incredibly frail. He probably needs to be held up on times. But even all that physical frailness, and it even sounds that way when he gets up at the Vatican. But I will tell you, I mean, I've read some of the stuff that he's been writing about. He's a mental giant, you know, and he has this real sort of sense of purpose and integrity and an ability to sort of put positions together. And I guess my question to you, Stephen, and frankly to Bill, is that, yes, he's one of one. But you and I both know that no executive actually operates by themselves. And so much of the decision making, most of the time, he will have time to make those decisions. I don't want to defend the fact that he's old, but I think that we also make age such a negative thing, as if somehow you don't have an ability to make a robust decision. Not necessarily present robustly, Stephen, but that you can't make a robust and informed decision. And I trust so much of what he has in the way of institutional memory that there is some significant value to that, Stephen.
No, I agree 100%. There was a great op-ed in the New York Times the other day talking about the things that you lose with age, especially this type of advanced age, but also what you gain and the wisdom, and that he may not be able to remember the details. He may not be able to process things as quickly, but, you know, by all indications, he still is able to come to thoughtful, appropriate decisions. And that's good. So, you know, it's not like I'm like, oh, he's old, he's hopeless, get out of there. And again, given the alternative, right, which one of us wouldn't take, you know, a potted plant. But, you know, it's all, you know, no politicians are ever perfect. And Joe Biden's imperfections, honestly, right now, I think are significantly about how his age has cost him. But that doesn't mean he's not necessarily up to the job, especially because the president, it's the presidency. It's not a single individual. It is.
That's my. But let me just say something more, because let me just go back to his age. But let me also say something else about him. Remember, for the first 2 years he was in office, Bill Curry, what was the one word that never left his lips? Abortion. The problem is he had to be talked into it. Then he had to be explained. And then he had to see that it was a democracy issue. Then he had to see that it was a women's equality issue. And then he's sort of turning it over to his vice president, who I believe has never had children. So I'm not sure that this issue is. And I mean, I'm going to just say that, you know, it's easier for a woman who's had those issues to pay. And I'm not going to marginalize her, but abortion is such an important issue. And frankly, it's got to come out of the president. The lead here is the candidate who's running against Donald Trump. This is something that he is so uncomfortable with, given his history as a public official. And this is the time where if someone is going to be a mental giant and be vigorous and be the crusader, he's not exactly the person I would have chosen, Bill Curry.
Yeah, I just want to push back on something, and each of you said it well, and Dahlia Lithwick said it well in her piece. That is that the White House is more than the person who presides
yes.
over it. Having spent a couple of years as counselor to the president, I certainly saw that firsthand. But I also saw that in the end, everything flows from the leader. All those choices. When they used to say about George Bush, well, he's not that bright or well-read, but don't worry, he'll get really great people around him. And the question is, well, how will he know which people are really great? And if he has two really great people disagreeing in a meeting, which happens all the time, how will he know which one to go with? And of course, he didn't on so many huge issues. So I just think, I think there's still an issue here. And if nothing else is a political issue, can an old man be president? Yes. Has Biden shown himself, has shown me the ability to attract the kinds of people who can envision the agenda we need, the compromises we need, progress we need to make? Not really.
Wait a minute. Let me stop you on that. That's not true. Take a look at what he's done when it comes to issues of consumers, of monopolies, of labor, of whatever. I'm telling you, some of the most progressive people on the planet are part of his cabinet. He has shocked me at how more than willing he is to. I mean, he's a pragmatist. Okay, he's not an ideologue. He becomes the moment.
He hired the mayor of Boston to be his labor commissioner, who didn't do much while he was there. He hired some very good people on monopolies. Nothing.
I'm monopolies.
We're in year four. I'm waiting to see what comes from it. The major bills are sort of supply side progressivism. Everything's a tax break on the energy front. We'll see how well it works. Other countries are approaching it differently. We'll see how well it works. And one other thing I'll tell you about the White House. I used to go to the morning staff meetings, and cabinet secretaries were always sidling up to me because I was on the inner political circle. And trying to figure out what happens. I went to all the cabinet meetings. They're mostly cheerleading meetings. A very small group of trusted advisors, many of whom I've worked with and know from previous incarnations, surround Biden, and they're not great progressives. There's some wonderful, I love Ron Klein.
Was great.
Yeah, but in terms of the vision, in terms of the political decisions, they've been sitting for a year trying to decide whether Joe Biden should lower the cost of drugs that taxpayers paid for research and development on that have been found to be price gouging. He has the authority. He has to just get up tomorrow. No one questions the authority in this one. He could do an executive order tomorrow and bring down costs of a fundamental necessity of life for millions of Americans and correct a wrong in doing it. And they don't know, because anything which isn't the least bit populist or goes against the grain of their donors, they get really shy. And that's who they are.
So that will be true of a younger president, too. Money is so corrosive in politics. You've watched what people have done. And you're suddenly saying, just because she's 52 or he's 57 or whatever, that they're not going to be influenced by big pharma, by big insurance, by big whatever. They all are. The system is so rotted out that way.
Let me just say this. I agree that Joe Biden will probably be the nominee. And I agree that he's a decent man. I agree that some good things have been done. And I agree that the alternative is just the gates of hell. And so that, you know, we can't go out asking for Jack Kennedy. It doesn't matter. We have to motivate ourselves.
Exactly. That's exactly. And I actually
but this
wrote a
party,
piece like that,
which is tied with a fascist. This party, which trails the Republicans in the generic congressional vote by 2 points, even after their stunning display of the last year, this party needs to have a reckoning with itself.
Yeah.
And I don't think the Biden crowd is likely to lead that. And I think that their inability to do so leaves us very vulnerable, not just because of who our candidate is, but because of what our identity is.
So I want to talk, Stephen, because you want to talk about guns. I want to talk about guns too. Okay. And so after what happened with the Kansas City Chiefs parade, you heard me start with that incredible tweet, which I think really sort of says it all. And it was the one where she writes, over 800 police officers were at the parade today and over 1 million civilians who were allowed to be armed, yet they couldn't stop a dozen people from being shot. I mean, I don't care where you are now, a parade, a 4th of July parade, an elementary school, some come with intent. Maybe you're in the middle of some sort of gunshot at the OK Corral. Who knows? But the problem is these were really young people with weapons of war in a place that was densely packed where there was supposed to be, quote unquote, a celebration. I said, in so many ways, what has happened with this gun culture? It has destroyed our opportunity to experience joy. That's what they're doing. No place is safe. Can't go to church, can't go to the shopping mall, can't go to the Kansas City Chiefs, and just be smiling, because now what happens, whether it was intentional or not, with this firefight, there are guns everywhere. How do we talk about this, and how do we seize the moment again that we will lose? And I know we will lose it, but I'm just so disgusted.
Why did I say I wanted to talk about guns?
I don't know.
Right? It's so depressing. It's so depressing. I don't have any answers. You know, nowadays I go to watch my local high school basketball games, and I have to go through the metal detector because you actually have to legitimately worry. And there's like 100 people there. And we shoot up. We have this Kansas City. You would like to think, right? You would like to think that this is the type of focusing moment, you know, a Super Bowl celebration parade with a mass shooting event. And like, this could be the focusing moment. But I forget who said it, but, you know, look, when we decided we could sacrifice those kindergartners in Sandy Hook and do nothing, that just showed we gave up. And so I don't want to say I'm hopeless and fatalistic on this, but yeah, man, give me some reason to hope, Arnie or Bill, because it is okay, Donald Trump is the worst, saddest thing in American politics. But after that, I think it is where we are with guns.
And Stephen, I just want to continue on this conversation because I saw an article, it was a research paper out of the University of Albany, someplace up in Albany. And listen to this, half of black males and 40% of white males will have been arrested at least once by the age of 23. Do you hear that number? That's incredible. I mean, I knew about black males, but I didn't compare. The black males are at 50%, the white males are at 40%. Both numbers suck, okay? Because what that means, if you have any kind of an arrest record, is that it really will sort of have an impact. I mean, if having a baby for a woman is a problem because they're gonna deny her access to an abortion, having an arrest record is bad for a boy, okay? I'm just gonna tell you. So that's what they're carrying. And what I also put out was, which is why I'm talking to you, is that I said, are you frightened yet? And then add this to this number. Most of them have easy access to weapons of war. So look at the arrest numbers and look at the fact that they're all weaponized. And still, we're in this collective denial as somehow you can arrest your way out. You can't. And what happened at the Kansas City Chiefs parade proves you can't arrest them out. You can't hire enough cops to make a difference.
I mean, and I got to say, you know, this people and their American exceptionalism, we are exceptional in this. No other country in the world does this. No other country in the world has this problem. Like, this is a choice we are making. This is a choice, an awful choice our politicians are making for us to sacrifice lives every single day. And I don't know. And the American people are standing for it. They're voting for the politicians who are doing this. I don't know.
We've been talking about, you know, with women and Dobbs, and you've been seeing, you know, women that have to flee Texas and they have to flee their states because, you know, their lives are on the line. That's just a tiny percentage of the women who need an abortion. Okay. There are just so many more than that. And remember this, remember when there was not an exception for rape in Texas to have an abortion? And what was the answer of Governor Abbott? He'll arrest all the rapists. That was his answer. We're going to get rid of rape. And I think
I thought he offered to raise all the children. Wasn't that also part of his in and bring him into his own home? Yeah. Wasn't that part of it? Yeah, well, I just want to say, Stephen said, is there something positive or optimistic to say? And I'll say two things. One, progressives have won every culture war in the history of the country. We always end up winning race, gender, gay marriage. It one thing after another. It's hard when you're fighting it. And we've already won the two biggest cultural war issues of this election, reproductive freedom and guns, and with the public overwhelmingly. And I seldom tell Democrats to run on culture issues, but I do this time. If we hit it hard and smart, those two issues can drive this election as much as any.
All right, we need to go to a break. We're going to lose Dr. Stephen Green, a professor of political science at North Carolina State University since 2002. Thank you for doing this, Stephen. You got to come back. That's all I have to say. And we'll continue on with our conversation with Bill Curry. We lost Scott Braddock, but hey, an hour of Bill, what the hell? All right, everyone, this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Navalny, who courageously fought against the nasty authoritarian regime that is Vladimir Putin's in Russia, has died in prison. This is very unfortunate and is both a setback for efforts to make Russia more democratic, but also evidence of the cruelty of Vladimir Putin and his regime. And if you need more evidence of that, which you shouldn't, maybe take a look at what's been going on in Ukraine for about 2 years now, longer if you go back to 2014. Russia, in February of 2022, launched a full-scale, brutal invasion of Ukraine. I will not go into the details of the horrors there, the crimes against humanity the Russian military has committed there, etc. But I want to make this point. Navalny died in prison. The Republicans in Congress who want to hold up any further assistance to Ukraine and thus pave the way in their minds for a Russian victory there are complicit with the regime that arrested and killed Alexei Navalny. This is who the Republican Party is. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
America's experiment with executing people continues, thanks to Alabama. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The preferred method of capital punishment used to be hanging, but hanging could be gruesome. And in the 1890s, New York, followed by other states, switched to the electric chair, which also could be grim indeed, as could be other methods of execution. The firing squad, for example, and the gas chamber, first introduced in Nevada in 1924, but used infrequently. And lethal injection, introduced in Oklahoma in 1977, an experiment that has gone so badly so often that there's a name for it, botched executions. Then, in 2024, Kenneth Smith became the guinea pig for Alabama's experiment with nitrogen hypoxia, a process that replaces oxygen with 100% nitrogen. As always, the government executioners claim that the new, utterly untested method would be neat and painless. According to Smith's spiritual advisor who attended the execution, it wasn't. More concerning, the argument about execution methods misses the point. Why does the United States, unlike most other countries, still have the death penalty, a system that is racist, classist, and arbitrary, and often targets not the worst offenders, but the most vulnerable people among us, a system with the purpose of vengeance that too often convicts the innocent? The majority of states no longer use the death penalty. Someday, none will. Someday. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
Teaching kids to save water on this current cast. Hear the pitter-patter of little feet around your house? If so, you can teach your children to keep their water footprint small, even as they grow in size. The key is to make water conservation fun and simple. Try approaching it like a game. For example, help your kids read the meter and then see if your family can use less from week to week. Set goals and rewards for success. When your children brush their teeth, show them how to shut off the faucet so it does not drip. Teach older kids to take shorter showers and set an example by practicing water conservation yourself. These simple lessons can help your kids develop lifelong habits and an appreciation for our natural resources. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Sometime when it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this,
All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
To Dr. Stephen Green for the first half hour, because we lost Scott Braddock, who had issues, but I love Scott. But the good news is we have Bill Curry for the whole hour. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut and an advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton. Again, reminding you, he was a head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. So I wish you could have heard the conversation between the first half hour and the second half hour. And Bill said, are we on the air? I'm like, oh no, oh no. So William, I'm looking at a couple of stories. I'm looking at the special election in New York, all right, where we thought going into it that it was close. It wasn't close. It was like a romp. But of course, everyone keeps saying, is it a bellwether? And we actually were talking with Ross Barkin, who used to write for The Observer, by the way, but quit as soon as they endorsed Donald Trump. But so Ross knows a lot. And he said, this is not a bellwether in any way, shape or form. I mean, he's looking at the Republican that Swazi was running against, and she was still a registered Democrat at the time that he was running against her. I mean, you can't make this up, you know? And she was, I think she was from Ethiopia. She lived in Israel. She'd been in the Israeli army. She did an under the radar campaign. The Republicans didn't spend half as much as the Democrats spent on Swazi. Swazi had been the former executive counselor, I think, on Long Island. So everybody knew him. Plus, he'd been a three-term congressman. Plus, he ran against Kathy Hochul. That's why she hated him. I mean, there were so many reasons why the Democrats had so much going for them that one of the things I thought was interesting is that they didn't just look at the fact that he beat the Republican, who was still a Democrat, but that they basically said, see, he used the border. He used the border and he made it his issue. And therefore, Democrats should not run away from the border. And although he did use abortion as well, abortion was not necessarily as resonant an issue as it might have been in a place like Texas or Florida, because everyone in New York still has access to abortion. It's a blue state. A lot of people are coming to New York to actually have their abortions. But let me just say something. You were saying, like, what's our message? What's our policy? Where are we going? What are we presenting to the American people as our vision? And I'm gonna even just touch real quickly on the abortion question in New York. And that is, here's what I would have done if I were Swazi. I would have said, I know you're lucky, we're in New York. So we're gonna protect a woman's right to choose. But let's talk about your children. Do your children wanna move to Texas? Maybe. Do they wanna move to Florida? Maybe. Do they maybe want to move? I mean, and go through all these states that have denied women's access to abortion. So you know why you need to have me in Congress? To protect those kids that want the dream of living in Austin or want the dream of living in, you know, whatever, Tallahassee, because they have a right to live anywhere in this country. But by going to certain states, look at the rights they lose. And we haven't even learned how to frame that issue in a blue state, because I'm not quite sure we even understand how powerful and potent this sort of democracy question and women's equality issue is. And that was a way where people gave him a pass. I'm not giving him a pass, Bill.
I think that I'd say two things. The 54%, just under 54% that he won, I don't regard that as a landslide anywhere. We actually use these characterizations with in an increasingly profligate way. But a 54-46 race was hard fought and closely contested. And secondly, it's a district that Biden also won by 8 points last time out. And no one thinks that Biden would run as well there as Swazi just did. I don't know anyone. I don't think anyone believes that. And so it's a reminder on the presidential level to me of just how much work there is still to be done. Swazi's outspent his opponent like 10 to 1, and he was an incumbent with name recognition. I do think it's a good sign that we're winning races like that in the Pennsylvania legislative race that are in these suburban, more affluent swing areas. It shows well to me for the House race, for taking the House back. I think it's more indicative of that than it is of the presidential race, which is so critical now. But I take a little hope from it. And the second thing is that, just talking about the issue he did address in his ads anyway, was immigration. And he didn't actually say anything about it specific. No one can tell you what his position was. But the difference between he and the most Democrats in leadership is, number one, he talked about it at all. Okay, it's the first way you signal to people that you're not really afraid of the issue, that you are intent on doing something about it, and that you're engaging them. And the second thing is, of course, that he simply said that he was for stronger border security and that he would have supported the law that was proposed. And the law that was proposed, it won't stop to go over it, but I will just say this, that we need to talk to our base. The people we've been afraid of are our own base. And we haven't wanted to say to them, you have to have immigration into this country under the rule of law.
Exactly.
And we have to tell the American people that we agree that it is of paramount importance to protect the borders of any country. Their first ask of us is that we keep them safe. And for any country, that starts with your borders. And above all, as progressives, we are pushing the rule of law. We are pushing faith in democracy and the rule of law. We can't have one big gaping hole in that argument. We can't. And remind our base of all that you get back. I mean, our progressive activist base, that for that, you get citizenship for the dreamers. For that, you get judges at the borders. For that, you get a path to citizenship for all the immigrants who came here and who live in a shadow black market economy without rights. So often we get,
and for that you get temporary work visas. Wait a minute, let me just say something. A lot of people don't want to stay here. They want to come here. They want to work. They want to send remittances back to Venezuela, to Peru, and they actually want to go home, but they want to work. Well, you know, what happened to that concept? Not everybody wants to stay here, and I don't blame them. You know, their kid might get shot, you know, at a parade. We need the physical workers. We do, because of our aging demographic. There are people, I mean, they're already here, but they're just not protected because they're under the radar. Like I keep telling everyone that in Houston, Texas, there are 600,000 undocumented workers. And guess what? Does Governor Abbott go after the 600,000? No, he goes to the border. Well, wait a minute. He doesn't like undocumented workers. Well, the reason why he doesn't say anything is, where do they work? In oil and gas. Where do they work? In the restaurant industry. Where do they work? Repairing roofs. He wants those 600,000 to stay under the radar, but he's going to go after the person that's coming across the border. They're all hypocrites, Bill. They're all hypocrites. And I think Swazi had something going for him, because you mentioned that he mentioned immigration. So let me just say something. He even said it, all right? So here's the point. Let me read you a headline from the end of January from NBC News. You ready? GOP seizes on illegal immigration as the issue in the New York race. Now, the reason why that didn't work for the GOP is that what Swazi also benefited from was what happened in the Senate, where they had the strongest anti-immigration law put into place to actually enhance it. And then it was the House and Congress and Speaker Johnson that basically said, don't even bother sending it to me. It'll never see the light of day. So he was also able to say, there was something, we could have done something, and it was Republicans that killed it. And that is an interesting timing.
It helped, and it'll be a good rhetorical point in this coming election. But I do think that at the same time, we have to be proactive, and we have to put our agenda on the table.
Yes,
we have
I
to
agree.
Talk about, we have yes. to offer a few specifics to let people know. But that was the best news of that race. And the best news of that race was that what he really said was not, as I read it, and not I'm going to be a total border hard ass.
Yeah.
What he said was, I worked for a compromise when I was in office, and I would have supported this one under the circumstances, and I will seek compromise. And all the polling data I've ever seen, at least, says to me that most Americans are not xenophobic. They don't bring a racist attitude to this. The vast majority support citizenship for people here, and a path to citizenship. They support the Dreamers. There are so many things that we want done here that we already have a consensus on, but we have to say the whole plan out loud in order to make the consensus politically effective. That has to be done.
Not only are they not xenophobic, and not only are they less afraid of the immigrant, but they've been told to, because somehow the idea is that the immigrant's going to take their job. But then the question is, where did the job go? Well, the job, as a result of NAFTA and so many of the other things that we have supported, the job went overseas. The job went to Vietnam and went to China. And then we left these sort of like manufacturing deserts all over the Rust Belt. And we did a really fabulous interview the other day with a guy from Michigan about what Ro Khanna talks about and what the president talks about, which is the idea of remanufacturing. I hope it isn't all about tax breaks. But anyway, we talk about the remanufacturing. And Bill, when you look at where those facilities and where those hubs are going, they're all over the Rust Belt and Western New York State. It's unbelievable. That's where they all are going. And it's places that basically people are going, but those are not places where people voted for you. No, those are places that felt abandoned, and they've been legitimately abandoned. So I also think that you have to not only talk about your policy, talk about immigration, but then talk about what has to happen in those places. It's not about an immigrant taking your job. It's about you finding a good quality job. And this is what we are investing in.
Yes. At the same time, the great majority of the jobs in the last report that we had on, that was so encouraging and got such rave reviews, were part-time. A disproportionate number were part-time jobs.
Yeah, I know.
And there is a precarity to the condition of the working middle class that has eased only slightly. And our constantly lecturing people that they should be more appreciative of what we've done for them, even insofar as it's true, I think a little less of what's of the legislation that's been passed than some of my friends do, but I support it and I'm grateful for what we've gotten. At the same time, I don't tell people that people whose drug prices put badly needed drugs out of reach, who can't get other health care, who are seeing their mortality rates rise, their life expectancy fall, their suicide rates go up, their opiate addiction rates go up. Their kids aren't getting to college. They lost their defined benefit pensions ages ago. They're entering old age now. So many millions of boomers entering old age, surprise, surprise, broke.
Yeah.
And so we have to be out there. We're supposed to be the tribune of such people. That's our role. That's the historic identity and mission of the Democratic Party. For it to succeed, that has to be restored. I really believe that.
And you're still looking at, there has been an incredible cost spike in food from before the COVID. I think someone said it was like 20% or 25%. You look at the cost of housing. There's been an incredible spike in the cost of housing. And then you look at the cost of drugs. So when you think about what families need for survival, they need food and shelter and an ability to stay healthy. Because if they can't stay healthy, they can't work. Okay, let's be honest. There's a connection here. And again, one of the things I keep thinking about is that when we did have control of Congress, when we did have a chance to do the Health Care Act, when we did have the things, once again, we watered down what we were able to do. And what do we see Republicans do? They're given an inch and they take a mile. We're given a mile and we take an inch. Okay? I mean, that's exactly what we do. And I think that that's another thing that the Democrats can say is that there's an urgency to this moment, and it isn't just about fascism versus democracy. There's an urgency to this moment to make sure that our economy is actually really finding you, helping you, because the challenge is going forward because of, for example, the climate crisis, all these things. If we don't provide you with a sense of security and safety, then it'll even do more damage as the challenges go forward.
In the last week, Biden was very good on grocery prices. And he said something about the behavior of the great big grocery chains in keeping prices inflated, even when their own cost had come down. And that was good. There wasn't an understandable action attached to it. So that's bad. And at the same time, as I mentioned the first half of the show, he's sitting with the legal authority to bring down drug prices where price gouging has been identified. It goes far beyond any drug relief that's been in anything he's done, the 10 Medicare drugs that he'll be negotiating prices on in 2026. He can snap his finger and do that right now, and people need it, and the behavior of the pharmaceutical companies is wrong. And so that kind of populism, it's not about name calling. You know, it's not enough, given that people understand that both parties have been so cozy with big money that often, you know, the donors get the policy and the voters just get the message. Well, they're finally getting the message, actually.
Yeah.
So if you want to get up and say you're going to do something different, you have to actually do something different when you say that. And you can't have these contradictions lying all about you, or no one will hear you.
Well, and let's say something else. And you know that they will take you to court. Let them.
Yeah.
Let them. Sure. Fight the fight. I want them to hear the attorney general defend the administration. I want them to provide them with the arguments. I want them to hear the fight. I want them to hear. If you're afraid because someone might sue you, then don't bother being a president. I'm sorry. You know, it comes with the territory. And don't be afraid of that, because sometimes it can become almost, it's a better PSA for what you are doing than saying, I will do this if I get reelected. If you can do it today, and they tried to stop you the way they did with the border, for example, which is what Swazi was able to ride into. He didn't just talk about immigration. He talked about the hypocrisy of, well, we offered it to you and they killed it. That was his strength. His strength wasn't even what was in the immigration bill. It was that they tossed it up and you basically shoved it back. So I do think that what Biden has to do, which is not necessarily in his wheelhouse, is that not only does he have to sort of be aggressive, he has to do it. You're absolutely right. Let the chips fall where they may, but let people see him fighting for what they know they need.
You know, we've talked a lot over the recent shows about both Ukraine and Gaza, and along with the border, those are the three issues he's most vulnerable on.
Yes.
I think it seems to me now, at least, that the economy may actually be moving along strongly enough to take a little bit of the inflation stuff off the table. If it hasn't done well enough, then that will be the fourth, clearly. But if you look at all those,
about Gaza, what does he do about Gaza?
It requires explanation. And Gaza, again, you need an action. You need he says he's doing, the administration leaks that they're putting pressure on the Israelis, having talks with Arabs, that they're concerned about what's being done in Gaza. And it's an old style diplomacy that Biden is actually very good at and is sometimes useful. You need public diplomacy right now. He has to come out and state our position and Israel's position for most of the last 75 years was support for two-state solution. Israel got off the bus about a decade ago. And we have to come out and say, not just that we're for it, because we've been mumbling that all along. We have to come out and make it clear that we will recognize a Palestinian state, whether Israel does or not.
And on top of that, you keep saying they're negotiating, they're doing backdoor deals. People are starving and dying by the second. Time you delay, a day for you is 1,000 deaths for them. And I'm sorry, I can't accept that anymore.
I agree strongly. And at the same time, though, one other abstract principle to add, that the first cause here is humanitarian.
Yes.
No question. It's direct and it's immediate. But the second thing is, when I talk about two-state solution, it's because there are two great rights here. The right of the Israeli people to be safe and the right of Palestinians to self-governance. And the right to self-governance, as far back as the Boston Tea Party, is in the genetic heritage of our country. This is how we got started. This is what it was all about. And still should be. And so when we're out in a situation like Gaza or Ukraine, by the way, this also applies, and not telling people what the fundamental principle is, what we're there for, and then not living up to it. In Ukraine, I've thought from the beginning that one, we should be defending Ukraine because Putin is a militarist and a fascist. I don't buy all the arguments about because this is our security down the road. You start talking like that, you can't help but sounding like Tom Friedman. You know, you just end up talking abstractions to people. In Ukraine, there's a right to self-determination that we are also defending. But that might include, in the end, the rights of some of the people in eastern Ukraine to have UN-supervised elections in which they state where they want to be. But the American people in both Ukraine and Gaza, if we were more avowedly and publicly and concretely implementing our own values and standing up for them, then I think that they would understand much better than they do. But it means a different policy. Again,
if you don't mean it,
then don't even bother.
So when you said something, it just triggered something that had been, there's a huge fight on my Facebook page. Don't even go there. So I wrote the following. I wrote, Bibi is a Trump accomplice. Together, their inhumanity is doing more damage than Xi or Putin could ever have accomplished. Bibi is killing Palestinians and destroying Israel's search for safety and security. And Trump is prepared to offer up America to the highest bidder, be it a Musk or a Putin or a Leonard Leto and his billionaire network. That's what I posted on Facebook. And that's how I feel. I mean, these are all self-inflicted. These are all about the decisions that we can and must make. To follow Bibi or to say to support Israel is actually to push away from Bibi, to do the opposite of him, to do all the things, the ceasefire, the two-state solution, all those things. In the end, what Israel wants is to feel safe. With Bibi in charge, they will never be safe.
And both Israel and the United States suffer right now from having a dominant politician whose sole purpose in life is to arrogate power unto himself, to enrich himself, with corruption in both cases, pervasive corruption in both cases. And what they are doing inevitably is for themselves, not for their country. And people have to see the politics of that Bibi's playing. I know it's going to be hard in Israel. I know that because of the trauma of this awful, awful event of last October, that'll take a long time to heal and to understand. But we have to make clear the fundamental universal principles upon which we as a nation conduct ourselves.
Yes.
And we have to become more loyal to those principles than we have been. And we have to become more public about our decision-making, both our diplomacy and our internal decision-making. We have to take American national security and foreign policy public.
And this is not a time for me to hear that, you know, Joe Biden is working behind the scenes. This is one time where it doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't fly.
And he accomplishes some good things that way. You have to come to the American people and seek their validation. And also remember that we have no power as great as the power of our ideas and of our ideals. That is the great power we can wield in this world. America was at its most influential when it didn't even have a standing army or navy in the late 18th century when we were first formed. But the power of our ideas was so great that it swept governments from power across the world and created a new age. And we have lost our own connection to our own greatest power. And in Gaza and in Ukraine, we have to begin to make sure that we've conformed our behavior to those ideals and then express them.
Well, how do you do that?
How do you do that?
Yes.
Well, I think first of all, by saying that, just making it clear two things. One, that we're going to pass this arms bill that Biden has worked so hard for. But that's it. Until there's a real commitment to a two-state solution, we have to begin to recognize that this Israeli government and the American people have two different views of what should happen here and of what's important. And secondly, we have to say to all the Palestinians, you have a right to a state, and this is going to be a hard road, but we're going to stand by you as strongly for your right to self-determination as we stood by Israel for their safety. And that means we will, you put a government together, we will recognize it, we will support it, And we will also up considerably from what is in this bill, the humanitarian support.
Yes,
that's some things.
Sorry, Bill. I'm asking you to close the show because Arnie's power went out.
Oh, okay. So.
Done.
Arnie has by happenstance given me the great privilege of thanking all of you for listening. She'll be back on Monday, and I'll see you next Friday, and thank you for listening. You bet.